to you.
Thank you so much, Tom. So, hi everybody. A couple of housekeeping things. I'm Ruby Booth. I work for Sandia National Labs. Can you hear me okay? I should probably be near the microphone.
Hi, I'm Ruby Booth. I work for Sandia National Labs. We're an FFRDC. We're one of the nuclear labs. An FFRDC in the United States refers to an organization that that works as on a nonprofit motive and is sort of our integrity is perceived as being above reproach. So when we give advice about something, we feel comfortable saying, "No, that doesn't do what you think it does." Or yes, that's a good good opportunity for you, and we're pretty trusted in that. That said, as you'll hear with most presentations, I think at Connections, these are my thoughts. These are not the policy of the U.S. government or Sandia National Labs. I do work with the U.S. government and obviously with Sandia on these topics. But if I say, you know, you need to worry about this, that's not the U.S. government saying that. So I am going to obviously tell you that AI will solve all of your problems and is going to be the perfect solution. And in fact, we don't need to war game anymore because we have the golden ticket. No, I'm not going to say that. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit, and for some of you, this may be review. Just let me just get a quick round of hands. Who here is pretty experienced with AI? Like, you know the background. Okay, so some of this is going to be a review, and I'll go through it pretty quickly. But for folks who don't have that background, this I find to be pretty useful. So we'll talk about the types of AI, the history of AI, and then we'll talk about generative AI, and we'll talk about AI in wargaming. So the evolution of AI over time, what we have is an interesting phenomenon with AI, where we keep calling the new thing AI, even though it's a completely new technology, or a technology built on the old technology, but quite different. So in the modern era, obviously there was there were things like the Turk in a box and things like that before, but in general, when we're talking about AI, we're talking about things that arose around the 1950s with the rise of conversations with Alan Turing and his colleagues. The Turing test is very famously this test where you can you tell whether you're talking to a person or an AI? It seems like a very trivial test now because it's quite easy to convince people that they're talking to a person. And in fact, it turns out the bar for being a person in a conversation is pretty low. But at the time, that was something that people thought computers could never do. If you go back and read the article, he's really talking about a very precise use case. As just a benchmark. So he's not saying once we've gotten there, we've got intelligent machines. He's just saying this is something along the way that we'll be able to hit. And he was right. Then in the 1960s, you have the rise of something called expert systems. If you think about the, I don't know if you had these car commercials here, but there were some Super Bowl commercials for a while with the little hand, the Waldo, that would paint a car, and they gave it a lot of personality. That's an expert system. It's programmed either electronically or with software to do a very specific set of tasks. It is simply following instructions. It will perform those tasks. So if you think about the early airline autopilots, that was an example of an expert system. We still have those. We still use them. When they first came out, we called them AI. Then we move on to the 1990s and the rise of machine learning, cluster analysis, these sorts of advanced algorithms, and those were going to solve all our problems, and those were AI. So we used those for advertising, we used them for email filtering, we used them for many, many, many things, and those were AI, and they were going to solve all our problems. And now we have large language models, we have generative AI and the associated materials, and that's AI, and it's going to solve all the world's problems. And at my lab, we're now talking about neuromorphic computing supported by quantum computing, and this idea of like, okay, now maybe whatever AI comes out of that is going to solve the world's problems. every time we've called it AI, it only gets the other name after we have a new AI to compare it to. Anybody in the business world? Anybody familiar with the Gartner hype cycle? Yeah. Okay, so the interesting thing about new technology is that this is the path. Gartner is a very specialized organization, but they're very, very good at what they do. So they say when a new innovation comes out that has some kind of market relevance, we start to adopt it. A few people, nobody knows who it is. We market it a little. It goes up. Oh my God, we're so excited. Blockchain is going to solve all the world's problems. Everything will be on the blockchain. And then we realize that it's actually only useful for like supply chain and maybe some monetary stuff. And in fact, maybe it's useful for nothing. Blockchain is terrible. Why did you make me buy blockchain? And then eventually we come up to the slope of enlightenment and into, yeah, it's good for some stuff. It's good for some stuff. We use it for that stuff. It's not a big deal. It's just another tool in our toolkit. No need to make it more than it is, but we know how to use it. The problem with AI is that every time we go through that loop, we call the thing AI. So we have a phenomenon that comes out of this called AI winter. So AI winter is a phenomenon where we get up here to the peak of inflated expectations, and everybody wants a project. Everybody wants an AI project because it's going to solve all the world's problems. The number of AI projects in the Department of Defense right now is cartoonish. The number of AI projects in industry is so big that we're talking about, you know, like the New York Times and the Atlantic agree, you know, and the Wall Street Journal all agree that we might be in an AI bubble. We don't know what it's really for yet, but we definitely think it's going to solve all the world's problems. When we start to hit the trough of disillusionment with AI, people who remember the last AI trough of disillusionment just start cutting their losses. And so instead of having this like nice, okay, we go up, we go down, and then we hit this middle ground, and there's some sort of continuous funding, AI tends to have this really big polar opposite, right? So you'll have an AI summer. We're in a hot summer right now. It is hot AI summer, and everybody is spending. And I would argue for those of you who actually are using AI and care about it, that you should begin insulating your high profile and high value projects from the coming AI winter, because it will come. Right now, people are saying it can do all kinds of things. They don't really understand what it can and can't do, and so they get overly optimistic, and then everything comes crashing down, and projects get cut. So be mindful of that. So you could model it using AI, but probably not a large language model. So why do we care? Like, what are we actually using this stuff for? For expert systems use rules. And those can be in the form of like a very scripted, like it's on the firmware, they could be software, but basically they use rules to perform tasks that it was taught to do. It tries to perform accurate actions. So if it's the Waldo and it's painting the car, it's trying to paint the car and not punch through the car's window, right? If it's an airplane, it's trying to fly the plane and not crash the plane. With machine learning, it uses what it knows to try and make accurate predictions about new data. So it's trying to generate accurate labels. So for instance, is this a cat or is it a not safe for work picture, right? We use it in categorization all the time. Should I market you this ad or that ad? And with generative AI and large language models, it uses the training data to create new data. And the data that it creates, what it's trying to do, is create accurate new content. So instead of just labeling, it wants to make something new. But that something new is based on what it was trained on. So it's going to use its corpus to make the next thing. So it's going to answer your question, but within the scope of that larger bank of data. So it's trying to generate essentially more of the same. So what happens when it goes wrong? Because this is really where, like, we feel like there's less a focus than there should be. is not just, hey, what are all the great things that can happen if we do it well? Because there are wonderful things that can happen if you do it well. But also, if it fails, in what way does it fail and what does that mean? What are the consequences? So expert systems make wrong actions. Instead of painting the car, punches through the window, you know, and your Waldo has to get taken out to pasture. If that's on an airplane, could be problematic. That's why instead of just having autopilots, we do still have actual pilots who can override. Machine learning, it makes inaccurate predictions. And by that, I mean it puts inaccurate labels on things. So one of the most famous and really tragic examples was there's a wonderful series of ProPublica articles about machine learning algorithms being used in the carceral system to determine the amount of time sentencing that people being convicted of a crime were like put in jail for, and whether or not they got parole. And when they actually did an analysis of that AI, its outcomes were no better than chance. And one of the reasons that this is very concerning is that a lot of the times for these companies, these algorithms are proprietary, and therefore you can't investigate it. So it's my personal position from an ethical perspective that if you can't analyze it, it doesn't have a place in a court of law, and probably it doesn't have a place on a battlefield. So if you get machine learning wrong, it makes inaccurate predictions, it gives you the wrong ads, it categorizes your data in the wrong way. So for instance, a lot of times when machine learning came out in the defense space, it was going to solve all our problems by auto-classifying all our material. So instead of you and I having to go through the process of looking at class guides, it was going to do this for us. So far this week, now it wasn't a machine learning model, it's a large language model, but so far this week I have had two different documentations going through our internal release program at Sandia flagged for their incredible sensitivity. One, because it refers to the fact that we make courses of actions in my game, which is, you know, obviously sensitive because I'm advising courses of action for the military. It doesn't understand that it's a game. It just sees courses of action, flags the material, and says, whoa, you're in way the wrong classification space for this. You know, and another one where we were designing a scope of work, well, you can't send that out to anybody because it describes work. Again, it's like, you know, they fail sometimes and we can tweak it, but we need to be aware that if that were a huge barrier, if it were something that there was no human oversight for, that could cause a problem. So what is generative AI, the thing that everybody's thinking about? What does it do if it goes wrong? It generates inaccurate content. So the way that large language models work is that all AI, but particularly generative AI, arises from an existing data set. So this is where the first danger comes in. What is that existing data set? For a lot of our use cases, and I'll talk more about wargaming and specific use cases, but basically they're trained and grow from a vast data repository of pre-existing information. So you have to think about what pre-existing information your large language model was trained on. For instance, ChatGPT, Llama, Claude, most of these were trained on predominantly English data sets. And so, you know, they may have included some other languages, but predominantly you're going to get, therefore, an English-speaking Western perspective to the model. Chinese AIs are trained on Chinese data sets. Some companies are working with translation in order to be able to diversify that, but that's the baseline. They're also trained on whatever data was selected, so it might be what data they could easily scrape. Because they're not necessarily going through the copyright processes to get legitimate access. They're not going to be trained on the publicly available ones are not going to be trained on classified data sets. So you can see, you know, you sort of imagine, like, if I'm in a room with a bunch of military experts and all we can talk about is at the unclass level, you get a very different briefing and a very different conversation than if you're able to go up to the higher classifications. So its reference bank, its brain, is trained on that level. It doesn't make it, it's not good or bad, it's just a bias that's going to be embedded in the AI. So then from there, it derives categories and constructs, like it structures its algorithms in order to be able to use, it doesn't matter from a technical perspective, it makes tokens and it figures out which tokens are most likely, so it's using a Markov chain, and that's all fine. But at the end of the day, what it's doing is predicting what's the most probable response, within some variability to your answer. So what do you likely want? And then it offers what it expects to come next. So the AI is always continuing an existing conversation. People like to talk about AI as an opportunity to like think laterally or get new options or really think outside the box, or, oh, it hallucinates, so maybe we could leverage the hallucinations. But really, it's just trying to tell you what sort of the average answer, right? It's just trying to continue the conversation. Additionally, so that's not necessarily bad. There are lots of contexts where continuing the existing conversation is useful. I'm going to talk about some of those, but you might think about things like injects, where you don't necessarily need something novel. There have been a million injects about, Russian expansion, about the South China Sea, whatever. So, it might be able to generate some good material there. But what I worry about when people talk to me about using it for policy, for strategy creation, for analysis of ongoing political activity. So, Putin put forward this, Xi Jinping said that, what does it mean? We have a tendency to want to use tools to help us understand these things. And one of the things I'm really, really worried about, particularly as we use AI in wargame development, but also in analysis, is this idea of reifying historical biases. So what do I mean by that? We have a model in our head of how our conflict works. We blue, we the US, we the UK, wherever you're from, we have a model. There's a lot of evidence right now coming out, some very good books have come out, that say that there were off-ramps to the Cold War that we missed because we had a model in our head of Russia's commitment to the Cold War and the fact that they were not going to back down. And because of that, we missed signals that they were giving that said, hey, maybe we're ready to wrap this, maybe we're ready to pack it in. Sometimes years before the actual end of the Cold War. And we did that because we had biases. So what I'm terrified of is us using large language models in strategy to help us understand our adversaries and help us understand the action space and reifying our own biases. So how would it do that, right? Because like AI is supposed to be really good at reasoning. It's supposed to be really good at coming up with new ideas. Remember, that's step one. It's trained on a corpus of data, and that data includes these things. So it includes real-world examples, sure. Real-world examples. We put real-world examples into it. But examples that we've scoped and labeled, right? So we give it a data set, and we have told it what's true and false in the data set, why they did this, causal analysis, things like failure analysis, things like that. We give it that information. Theoretical articles. I mean, we have many good friends in the deterrence space. So one of the areas that I work in is in deterrence research. And we have all these explanations for why we have not yet had a massive nuclear war. Are they right? We think so, but we're not really sure. And then cultural records. So if you think about it, 1950s newspapers, 1940s newspapers, coverage of various conflict are famously completely accurate and unbiased. No news article has ever been skewed in the victor's perspective or in the politics of the time or in the framing of the time, right? So if we put those in, it's got those perspectives. And volume matters, because remember, it's tokenizing this stuff and analyzing it, so if you have a lot of one perspective, it's going to tend to kick out things from that perspective unless it's weighted to the contrary. Game theoretic models built with parameters. Game theoretic models are fantastic. It's how we do a lot of deterrence research. But again, we picked them. So when you say, okay, I'm going to use this large language model to help me solve this problem in a novel way, A lot of times it's actually just going to solve the problem in the way that you, how you think about it. And then masses of military reports, right? So let's say you do, you have a cleared space, you put your model on it, you're going to give it all the military reports. And so it's my concern that using this may reify our biases and therefore cause...
Ruby?
Yeah.
Will you move on to places? Are you referring to ring-fenced, home-built LLMs? So the models are within your own terrain. You give them their own data sets. Or are you also referring to publicly accessible models?
Publicly accessible,
so
predominantly accessible.
Have you looked at poisoning of large language models by adversaries?
Let's hold questions for the end just because we're on a time clock, but then I would be happy to answer. So the rules of thumb that I have, use AI when tasks are low stakes, they're common in its corpus, and they use either text or images. You can use text and images at some point. I think in the future it's going to get good at that, but right now it makes your text look like garbage. Use AI when tasks are moderate stakes, time intensive, and can be reviewed. So there's a reason for not doing it as a person because it's going to take a lot of time, but you can look at it. And there's some examples here. Summarizing literature review, doing elicitation. Use AI when tasks are high stakes, can be robustly validated, and other methods are not tractable. Right now, I don't see examples of that in wargaming. I beg you not to use AI in the following spaces. White cell adjudication. You can use it to support white cell adjudication, but what you really want your white cell adjudication to do is focus on your research questions. And you can't do that if you're just getting stuff kicked out from the AI. Also, we tend to do that because we think if we use AI that the players are going to give us less guff. Players are going to give you guff either way. Don't worry about it. AI red cell, for the love of all that is holy, we only have like 6 red experts, and one of the only ways that we get our decision makers aware of the fact that we don't have enough red experts is that they can't schedule their war game because there's only 6 and they have to compete. So please keep that forcing function in place. Also, again, if you're using like a US made LLM to tell you what Russia is going to do, like, again, there's so many biases here. Also, words are not actions, so there's a lot of problems there. Don't use them to write up your findings. It's so tempting. It's so tempting. Load all that in. This is where you need to be an expert, so don't do that. The whole point of doing the game is in order to think about what you get out of it and make some intelligent decisions about that. So please, for the love of God, look, you can use it to help you find themes. You can use it in some ways. But write your report with your big brain. They've hired you because you got a big brain. Be the one that uses it. There are some great places you can use it. You can use it to help you kick out COAs when somebody's giving you 3 pages of COA and you need to pull it down to bullets to report out. But like, don't use it for this. Use AI that mitigates data bias. So there are some spaces for this. Balanced data sources, use bias techniques, and so forth. I'm running low on time, so I'm just going to speak to that very briefly. There are some things that exist, and they're going to get better because there's going to be more demand for them. But basically, the idea here is, how do we assess what comes out of AI when it's specifically designed to align to our biases? It's trained on our materials. It's going to sound good to us. We need to be very conscious that there's danger to using it. We use AI we use war games in what I call the complexity scarcity gap, where you can't model it from game theoretic principles, and it hasn't happened enough that we already know the answers. Validating AI outputs in this gap is really hard, because the reason we're running a war game there is because we don't have enough data. So the AI is going to sound good, and there's not really a robust way to validate it, so be very, very cautious. One thing I do think, we could turn it on its head and actually use war games to validate AI. So One, we could use war games as a data source, as an additional data source to feed into the AI to help mitigate some of that historical bias. And two, we could provide evidence to validate the model. So if the AI give us recommendations about conflict, we could use war games to test them. So I actually say, instead of replacing all our war games with AI experts, maybe we should replace a few AI experts with war gamers and get some robust feedback. This is a little tongue-in-cheek, but I really do think that this is an important pathway for validating AI use in strategic situations. I think war games could be very helpful. Thank you so much, and we'll have questions at the end.